Welcome back to Roaming with Restless Women. I'm Julie Noonan, your host, and today I have with us Terry Short. Terry is an author, a speaker, coach, and creator of Thriving Leader Collaborative, which I love the name of that, by the way, the thriving part. She believes that truly authentic leadership is achieved when we embrace our inner wisdom to overcome business challenges. Terry spent the last decade advising high-performing Fortune 500 leaders on how to live their fullest potential and bringing out the same in those that they serve. Terry's the author of The Words We Choose, Your Guide to How and Why Words Matter, and the co-author of the bestseller, The Great Leadership Awakening. I love that title as well. Terry is a leadership, productivity, and communications expert who is passionate about sharing resources that equip leaders to lead from the heart, prioritize well-being, and speak with intention and impact. She earned her MBA in healthcare management, her professional coach certification, PCC, and is a certified neuromindfulness practitioner. I might ask you about that as well, Terry. She leads the TLC team in offering coaching workshops, keynotes and retreats with a true sense of curating precisely what an individual team or organization needs to excel joyfully. So, welcome, Terry. I love your introduction. That's wonderful. You have so much experience. I can't wait to hear about it.
Thank you, Julie.
So, I always ask this question at some point during the interviews that I have. What is the red thread that you see that weaves throughout your whole career and your whole life? So what are you most passionate about? What do you do the very best?
I'd have to go with communication because throughout all of my different career, I did a bit of a jungle gym career approach, not climbing a ladder here or there, And always, when I was in hospitality, it was about communication. How did we communicate to the clients that we had? I was with Four Seasons, my expectations were very high. And so what was that level of communication? And then as an emerging leader, how did I communicate with my staff in order to be heard and be inspiring to them. And so it's a leadership wise, communication was always important. And then I end up in healthcare. And when I was in healthcare, thinking the difference it makes to a patient to have good communication from the physician, from the team, the dietitian, everybody, it makes or breaks the experience, really. So the red thread is communication.
Well, and I think too, one thing that people don't generally associate with communication is the timeliness of the communication. It's not just the words, although those are incredibly important, as you say in your book, but it's the timing. And as a change practitioner, like that's crucial in my line of work. If you don't get the message out before the thing happens, you're going to be disappointed with resistance. I can tell you that.
Absolutely.
So when you were in the healthcare field and you were providing services there, tell me about the difference between the healthcare environment and the hospitality environment.
Well, Julie, in my heart, there shouldn't be any difference,
There you
right? Now,
go.
there was, but in my heart, like that was what drove me, is that. And actually, to be fair, that's how I get into healthcare in the first place. So I sat on the Go Red for Women board in Missoula, Montana, and one of the other board members was the chief medical officer for our local hospital. Now, meanwhile, I had opened and was operating the largest luxury guest resort in the state of Montana, which still exists. And so he knew that that's what I did, and he was way ahead of his time. Because he said to me, "Well, we need your skills in the hospital." I was like, "Huh? What?" And what he was saying was, the level at which you have the team operating and how they're interacting with the guests, that's how it should be with the patients. And I said, "You're exactly right. That is how it should be with the patients and the team." So when we're engaging with the physicians, all levels of providers, the staff, at a certain level, and speaking to them with great kindness and respect, right? Then we're able, then they're empowered to turn around and speak to the patients in that manner. And so that's the same way it happens in hospitality. You have to treat your teams really well and elevate them, because then they're in turn going to turn around and speak very favorably, or let's say appropriately, to those that they serve, because their heart's in it. So it's a matter of kind of exposing the heart part of it, and why people are drawn to do the work that they do. And in healthcare, that's huge. I mean, people are seriously drawn to that profession.
And that is absolutely true. And unlike other professions or other organizations or industry types, in healthcare, you can't say, oh, nobody's going to die. If you don't get it right, people will die. And that can include, did you communicate everything that they needed to know? Did you
That's right.
communicate what your peers need to know in the situation? So tell me an example of a time when you had to coach a leader, doesn't matter what industry, but coach a leader who was struggling with communication with their team, and what was that, and how did you get them over it?
Well, I'm going to go first to coaching the physicians. So
Oh,
here I
yeah.
am. Imagine me in a patient room, in an emergency department room, and I have three physicians with me. I have one that is, we're doing didactic training. One's going to be practicing better communication skills. One's going to be the patient. So they love that role, because then they can
Oh.
just, be the patient. One's going to be the evaluator, and I was the fly on the wall. I was allowing them to do this triad training, and then they switch, right? And so I routinely, maybe every fifth to tenth time that I did it, I'd have a physician say to me, "Well, it really doesn't matter what I say to the patients. I'm an expert." And these weren't just ER docs. We would just do it in the ER. "I'm an expert surgeon," or "I'm an expert this," or whatever. And I'd say, "That may be true, and I'm super happy about that." And they were also pushing back as to, "I'm non-clinical. Why was I here training them?" And I'd say, "I have great respect for what you went through to be the expert in this field. I ask the same for me. I'm an expert in communication, and I'm happy to tell you how I got to that point. And so we all have our skills, and I'm here to help you upskill communication." And then I would paint the picture. So let's say the person practicing would say something, and I'd ask the patient, "How did that make you feel? And what more would you have wanted to hear from the physician, or how would you like to hear that differently? What difference did it make that so and so physician chose these words? What if they would have chosen those words?" And they'd all go, "Oh."
Yeah.
It was very eye-opening to them to see the difference, and to think, if that was my mother or my grandmother laying in that bed, or if that was my 6-year-old child, what
Oh,
difference would it
yeah.
make when the physician chose these words as opposed to these words?
Well, and the fact of the matter is, you see the actual physician or multiple physicians while you're there, depending on what your problem is. 3 minutes at the most, in most cases. So, what impression are you going to make in those 3 minutes? What is the
That's right.
number one thing that that patient needs to understand
That's
in
right.
those 3 minutes? And I think sometimes the way that healthcare operates, sometimes, I'm not saying this globally, obviously, but is because of the push on time. The last thing they're thinking about is how am I communicating? They're looking at what's my next thing, what's my next thing. And that's a shame because I don't know, being a patient, myself or my daughter just recently had a baby and had complications, everything depended on when that doctor walked in the room. They had all the information, and we were on pins and needles waiting for that, right? So
Right.
it's.
Well, I agree with that. And what I would add to that is that in healthcare, there's that hierarchy of the providers and everybody else and such. And that kind of messes people up too, because the hierarchy causes people to think that they're not playing a key role in the person's the delivery of their care. Here's an example actually that I have in the book. One time I was going past a room, and I heard the dietitian who was in the patient's room saying, "Well," the patient was asking an important question about something, and the dietitian said, "Well, I'm just the dietitian. And she minimized with the word just to word choice. She
Right.
minimized who she was. And I eventually spoke to this individual and I said, hey, so the thing with the patient was that unless the patient could understand the food that they needed to have and why they were having this particular food, and then were able to go along with that program, they weren't leaving the hospital because their body then wasn't going to be functioning properly. And so the nutrition part of
Yeah.
it is huge. So when I spoke to the individual, the dietitian, I said, well, hang on, talk to me a little bit about the role that you do play and the importance of nutrition to the patient. She's like, well, she's not going to get out of the hospital unless she does this. And it's like, oh, right. Then you're not just the dietitian. You're the dietitian, own that. And in that role, you're part of the caregiver team. And you're somebody who can answer certain questions about her care and then direct her to the right person or find the answers for the rest of her questions. And so how would that make that patient feel? And how would that add to her ability to progress and eventually leave the hospital? She goes, oh,
Yeah.
oh, I see. Right? So that's a part of it too, is everybody owning and leaning into what their skills are and what their
Absolutely.
contribution is. Yeah.
And so, you also work with teams on team communication, correct?
I do.
That's amazing. And so tell me about a time when you were working with a team and they just, you wanted to jump out a window, because I know I've been on some of those teams and it's not fun.
Yeah, so what I feel happens with teams is that, right now the term that everybody would use is that they want to create psychological safety in their team. And
Right.
I'm working with teams now that are working on that. Step one is, in order to have psychological safety, you need trust. And that's the foundation of that. And so step one is to identify the level of trust. So the level of trust that I have for the other team members and that I suspect they have for me. And so I've actually devised a bit of a trust assessment that's based on The Speed of Trust by Stephen Covey. It's an
Yes.
older book, but it's really good as far as the 13 behaviors related to trust. So I
Absolutely.
kind of force the introspection about the trust that one is giving and the trust that one is open to receiving. And we start there. Excuse me. So what happens is we go along and everybody's like, oh, okay. And we're building trust and all good. And yet there were choices in how to, in a loving, kind way, how to call out somebody who is denigrating that trust, or stabbing somebody in the back, or doing something that we've agreed upon is not part of our operating principles. It's that people hesitate to get over that hurdle of how to provide that feedback, as you said, in a timely manner, and in a kind sort of proactive, we're all in this together. I'm a huge fan. How I always, always, always coach Julie is that you tie everything back to your values or your guiding principles. So if you do
Yes.
or say something that affects me in a certain way, and I figure out why is that? Why did that rub me the wrong way? I can always relate that back to, should be always able to relate that back to what you said, not feeling aligned to one of the principles. Like teamwork or collaboration or integrity or whatever it is that we've agreed upon, that makes the conversation so much easier because now I can come back to you. I can lean on that. So that's
Right.
what I always do with, particularly the ones that are like, is
Right.
how does that align with your values? How does saying that align? How does what you hear align? And if it doesn't, what is it incumbent upon you to go back and say and fix it? Because the more we do that in real time, the bigger progress. You know that with change management, we do that in real time, we progress
100%.
forward, right?
And one thing that I've used in the past, when I know that the team needs to be able to be open and discuss difficult issues, is I'll give them a clue, a trigger. So, for instance, if you need to say something that might rub someone the wrong way, but you need to just say it. Say before you say that, say, I need to throw a dead fish on the table. And really and truly, it's
Love it.
funny at the
Yeah.
beginning when I introduce it, but also it kind of warns everybody that what's coming next might be offensive, or it might be, for if you're a gentle soul, it might be assertive or too aggressive, but that kind of prepares people to actually hear it. And then when they hear it, they're free to also throw a dead fish on the table if they need to, or to just be able to address it however they need to at that point. Just simple things like that really help, I think. And I know
Well,
you've used those as well.
you made me think of a little neuroscience. You said we might talk about the being
Yes.
the neuro mindfulness practitioners. So what I also coach people to do, so it's along those lines, before you would throw the fish, is to have a pivot practice, to have a moment where you're assessing sort of your own, the place that you're in, and if that's the right time to throw the fish on the table, right?
Right.
So I talk about the, from a neuros, we learn so much every day. I mean, every year there's so much information about how our brains work. So, we have these preconceived notions. I imagine this as a downward spiral, and beliefs and old stories and old voices, our third grade teacher telling us, it's like, our mother, whatever. So all this is in our mind. And could be building to, and then somebody says something that reminds me of this negative thing, spiral, and I'm going to that place. The what has to happen from a neurological standpoint is there has to be a break in that pattern for you to then build a positive. I see that as a spiral upward, so I call that a pivot practice, and you can do that anywhere. So I do this. This is my, I'm rubbing my
Oh.
index finger and my thumb together and feeling the ridges. So I can do this like right now under the table or at the boardroom, in the boardroom. Something's going down in the boardroom, and I can feel this is relating to something I've heard before. And I can physically, things are, my heart's beating faster, what have you. I'm going to do this to settle myself and to contemplate if it's time to throw the fish on the table. If this is the appropriate, am I in the right place to do that? And I'm going
Right.
to do my pivot practice first to ensure I'm in the right place. I'm headed in a positive spiral before. And therefore, what I will then do is respond and not react, which is huge.
It is huge. It is huge because when you react, you're dragging that story, that negative story, in the conversation with you, as opposed to acknowledging that it's there. I have a bias, whatever it is. Yeah, it's making me this situation makes me make up a story about myself, or reminds me of a story I've made up about myself. And then the emotion that goes along with it comes out.
That's right. So you do
Yeah.
the pivot practice to A, acknowledge that, and B, if possible at that time, to stop. To sever that pathway that you're going on. I call it the yellow brick road. If you don't do the pivot practice, you end up on the yellow brick road. You've been on that road a gazillion times, dum da dum da dum, and off you go. And each of those bricks has been laid very intentionally in the past. But you don't need to go on the yellow brick road. You could do a pivot practice and you can start a different narrative and choose different words and choose different beliefs, or at least it choose an openness to hear what the other people are saying.
Absolutely. Well, the tactile piece of that reminds me of positive psychology. Yeah, is that where you came up with? Yeah, I've been through that program as well, and it really does work. Especially, oh my gosh, standing in line. I pull that out all the time when I'm standing in line, just to say, okay, the world's not ending. It's not that big of a deal. Just calm down. Don't make an enemy out of the person in front of you want to smack because they, whatever they're doing. So tell me, we're just going to veer just a little bit. What's it like in your experience to be a leader, a senior woman leader? Meaning, not senior age-wise, but senior meaning experience-wise and delivery-wise. What does that feel like to you?
Yeah, that's so interesting. So let's back up a little bit. I was, particularly with Four Seasons, and which I was in, I was the executive housekeeper at the only five-star, five diamond Four Seasons in San Francisco at the time, when I was 25.
Oh,
So
wow.
I was the only skirt in the room for a handful of years, right? So here's what I think. I went, and then this is what I'm in the my coaching business to do, is help people feel sage at any age,
Oh,
right?
I
So,
love that.
when I think about me at 25, I'm like, oh my gosh, had I known these things I know now, right? And even at 30, and
Yes.
so there's that, there's my passion for helping younger leaders not have to wait till they're 50 years old to go,
Yes.
like, oh, okay, this makes much more sense now. So anyway, that's a key part of my coaching practice. And so now it feels that I'm more wise, for sure. It also feels to me that I'm in a position to give back and to help others be sage at any age,
Love
right?
that.
Yeah, and so it's a it's an earned and a privileged place is in my mind and in my heart. And so, for the rest of the time that I will be working, which is another decade or so, it's my passion to kind of help others and to share some of that experience and some of that knowledge. And I'm already started writing another book, Julie. So that's all part of that.
And what is it about? Sage at any age?
Well, I've thought about that. The working title right now is Leadership, What's Love Got to Do With
Oh,
It?
a lot.
Yeah, that's
In my
right.
mind, a lot.
That's right. So digging into, it's over this past decade and the coaching that I've done, it's become very apparent to me that self-love is where it all starts. Like the leaders that are out there coming from a fearful, angry place and fearing change, which is what you bump up against. And,
Oh, all the time.
they're making things up. They can't choose the right words to save themselves because they don't have the right level of first self-love in the first place. They don't have their own house in order, let's say. And so I think that's why so many people are turning to coaching, right? To be able to get that. And so that's my passion, is to help that the individual then learn to start there and then learn the role that they play in the organization, to take whatever those meaningful, lovely values are, some of which I touched on earlier, and understand how they're founded in love. They're founded in respect and compassion and empathy. All those things are components of love. And so how do we normalize that in the workplace? And it starts with those an army of those individuals,
Oh
right?
yes. And it we're kind of fighting an uphill battle, I think, in some ways, because emotions, when we were younger in our careers, I don't know how old you are, and I don't need you to say, but when I was younger in my career, any kind of soft emotion was seen as a weakness.
That's right.
And I allowed myself to play that hard, excuse me, that hard ass game, because
So did
that was
I.
the only way that I knew at that time to get promoted, to become a leader, to be able to have that seat at the table. Well, we should be beyond that by this point. I think we've taken a couple of steps back here in the last little while, but
Yeah, for sure.
one thing that I don't want to have to happen is for the younger generation of women to have to redo that, because that's not how women play best.
That's right.
We play best when we can tie things to those softer emotions.
That's right.
We can make so much better decisions that really impact everyone in a much better way than the dog eat dog. We don't need dog eat dog anymore. I guess
That's
we
right.
do for a while now, but
Well, and it's not gonna, it won't suffice. In the
no.
new paradigm, it just won't suffice. And the energy that the women bring is important and is vital to progress moving forward. So I have the utmost faith in that, as well as the younger generations, younger than me. They're not buying it anyway. They're
No.
not buying that, I need to stay in this lane and be the hard nose or whatever. They're bringing their full selves to the workplace and the needs that accompany their full selves, and that's lovely. They're better at setting boundaries, and so it's so I those two things together are what make me hopeful. And to be honest, it's not, at least in my own observation and my own coaching practice, it's not just the women. The
No,
men,
it's the
well,
men too.
the more, let's say, evolved men that I coach and that I interact with, they're ready for it too. They're ready for a different way, a different approach. And my thing about this hard and soft thing is that what the work that needs to be done is that we turn it on its end and say, this part of leading from the heart is actually hard. It's not the soft part. It's the hard skill that one, it's hard to develop that skill, and it's necessary going forward.
It's so much harder. It really is. And it takes more time. It's
Energy.
like an energy and thoughtfulness. And one thing that I struggled with for a while when I first started my business, and I had contracts with a within an organization that had a lot of young generational folks doing really important projects, which is awesome. What I struggled with was their intense need to collaborate. Because their intense need to collaborate in my old programming was you're wasting time. Somebody make a, blah, blah, blah decision here. Who's in charge? And it took me a minute to get used to the fact that when they were collaborating and they did make a decision, it was much more effective and it solved more problems than if one of them had stood out and said, we're doing this.
That's right. And it's
So
more long lasting because
much.
they put the collaboration up front instead of somebody up here making a decision and then, having to try to get it infiltrated everywhere.
Oh yeah, it changed a lot about how I do change management.
Great.
Yeah, it
Excellent.
really did. And that's been great. So I'm going to give you a chance to give me some wise words of wisdom for our audience, for the younger generation out there. And then I have three questions that I always end the episodes with. So I'm going to let you hold forth with the wisdom right now.
Well, this comes right from my book, and I hold this in my heart all the time, and that is that your voice is a choice. So when I talked about the internal dialogue, I see that as a personal podcast. People are listening to your podcast right now, and
Yes.
in general, though, they have a personal podcast on their headphones on 24/7. They're listening to this voice, right? And that voice, that internal voice, is a choice. You get to decide. You get to be the producer, director, narrator,
Yeah.
host, what have you. And so choose wisely, because when you think about your voice as the choice, it's you have the power to impact humanity and with your word
Yes.
choices. So choose wisely.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. Okay, the first of my three questions. I will ask you to close your eyes just briefly. And I'm going to say a couple of words, and then I want you to watch the image that appears in your mind and then come back and describe it for me. Wise woman. And you can open your eyes.
It's funny, I always have the same image when I do sort of guided meditations and such. It's always a wise woman is always in a long white flowy dress with longer than my hair and flowy gray hair. And so not in a suit and, just being her natural self. And oh, by the way, she would not be wearing a bra.
Or makeup. Absolutely. 100% agree with that. And where do you like to roam, Terry?
Roam, any kind of any hills. And my husband and I hike and hike and hike. And so we roam hillsides, mountaintops, peaks. We were just roaming around the trails of New Zealand for a month. And so we hike a lot.
Oh,
I roam a lot.
I am so jealous. New Zealand is on my bucket list for sure.
Yeah,
Oh.
well, the thing about the roaming there are there are no predators, so nothing can harm you. You can roam endlessly without any concern. And I
Oh
spend the
my
summers in
gosh.
Idaho where I carry bear spray just in my neighborhood.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. Oh my goodness. So, what makes you restless in a good way?
Oh, any kind of project that I'm leaning into with my full self, and I have a couple going on right now, and I'm totally restless. I mean, last night I said to my husband, "You know what? If you could just start such and such for the dinner, you know, get the asparagus on, I'll be back in just a minute and I'll finish everything." And then I came back and I was like, "Oh, and this and this," and I was like, completely. He said, "Hello, what happened in there?"
Energized.
Yeah, and I really was in the zone at the inappropriate time because it was dinner time. But
Well,
it makes me restless. It makes my head is, my mind is spinning, the creative juices are spinning, and I love that.
I love that too. And I truly believe that unless it hurts somebody, you should take advantage of those times when you get that spark.
For sure. Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, now I am a 8 to 9 hours a night sleeper, so I can like cut that off. I think that's why, because I
Yeah.
trust that I will use the energy appropriately during the day, and then I
Yeah.
shut it off and I go to sleep and I wake up ready to do it again, you know, fully rested.
And you are lucky in that. I know so many women, especially postmenopausal women, just literally cannot sleep. And I've never had a problem with it either.
Yeah.
So we are very lucky in that.
Very. Yeah.
Oh, well, Terry, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show today. I really appreciate it. Tell our audience how they can get a hold of you and learn more about either getting your books or engaging you for some work.
Absolutely. I've enjoyed being on the show and
Thanks.
conversing with you. So Terry, spelled Terre, at thrivinglc.com, and the LC stands for Leader Collaborative. So the website is
Okay.
thrivingleadercollaborative.com, and my books are there, and I write a lot of articles. I'm also that when you ask me what it means to be a woman, you know, a leader at my age, I'm very much into giving stuff away. So I have a lot of templates and a lot of articles and a lot of resources. And so have at it is what I say.
Oh, I love it. Thank you
Yeah.
so much. We'll
Yeah.
make sure to put your website links in the show notes. And
Great.
so also your LinkedIn
Yes. Yeah.
profile in
That'd be
case people
great.
want to get in touch with you there and connect with you there. I think that would be
Excellent.
awesome. Thank
Excellent.
you
Well,
so much again.
thank you. I appreciate you.